What's going on, guys? Welcome to One Perfect Game, the podcast about video games and the people who play them. I'm not your regular host, Matt Tilby. I'm Jono Peck, the host of the Putting in Work podcast. And we're doing a bit of a switch up, a bit of a crossover event this week for the Australasian Gaming Podcast Network. Yeah, it's a bit of a campaign, I guess, to promote each other's work as well as our own. And Matt has kindly recorded an episode of my podcast with writer and comedian Ryan Hunter, so you can check that out at 8bit.net. But for now, we are here to talk with Blake J. Harris, the author of Console Wars and the History of the Future, recently published. How are you going, Blake?
I'm great. Ever since I was a kid and I saw the Flintstones and the Jetsons in a crossover episode, I've always loved crossovers, so I really appreciate you having me on while you're hosting another show. It's good to be back talking to you, yeah. And it's good to meet these listeners for the first time.
Yeah, there's something about crossovers that they don't always work, but they're always interesting. I'll give them that much.
I agree.
Whether it's, I know that they tried to do like a Seinfeld-Friends crossover at one stage, but I'm pretty sure Larry David and Jerry Seinfeld would have stomped that idea out of oblivion.
That's true. And then amazingly, but Larry did basically do a crossover with Seinfeld on Curb, and I love that. So you're right. It's always interesting. So thanks for having me on. We'll make sure that this is interesting.
That's all right. And for people who follow my podcast, they will remember you from episode 101, where we did a real deep dive into your career as a writer and how Console Wars came together, writing about the battle between Nintendo and Sega. And of course, this recent book about Oculus and I guess the recent history of VR. So congrats on that book publishing. And how's it all going so far? It's been, what, a month or so?
Yeah, thank you. So I wrote Console Wars, and that came out in 2014. That was life-changing for me, as we talked about in your podcast, because I was able to go from my day job of trading commodities for Brazilian clients to writing full-time, and apparently writing full-time about video games. And so that came out in 2014. That and then now, 5 years later, in February, so a month ago, the new book came out, and so far it's been great. Everything I hoped. You know, writing is often lonely, pretty solitary experience, so you never know how people are going to react. So it's been thrilling to have mostly positive responses, especially for sometimes controversial matter. And this one was definitely a bit harder because there was a political element, but also just the fact that, like you said, it was a modern VR, and so it was happening as I was writing about it, and so I didn't have the luxury of a 20-year view on it. So I'm very happy with how it's been going.
Yeah, and it's still something that's, I guess it's a story that's ongoing, and people will be getting turned on to VR and the tech side of it as time goes on. So hopefully this can become the go-to book about that, the way that your first book has become with the Console Wars, and people can discover it and get into that history of Oculus and Facebook and VR and how all these things are kind of interplay together.
Yeah, that's the hope. I remember the first time when I contacted Palmer Luckey, the founder of Oculus, part of my initial pitch on why he and people at his company should take the time to speak with me for this book was that I said that when their first headset came out, which was in 2016, the Oculus Rift, their CV1 headset, I said that Player One would be ready, a reference to the great Ernest Cline book, Ready Player One, but that my book would be for players two through mom. So hopefully now and in the years ahead, players two through mom and anyone interested in VR or Oculus will read this book for a fascinating story or to learn about how we got to where we are with virtual reality.
Yeah. And I guess that the end of the book probably sets the table for what you see in the future. What's your personal take on VR? Like, we're here to talk about games today, but do you feel like it's where people hoped it would be by this point as far as the trajectory goes? And do you think that it's going to continue to develop and become more ubiquitous as time goes on?
Well, it's interesting that you sort of added that caveat about we're here to talk about games, because what was so appealing to me about Oculus early on, and I think was so appealing to probably several listeners or anyone who was, quote-unquote, an early adopter, was that Oculus's whole mission was oriented around gaming. You know, their tagline was literally step into the game, and Palmer Luckey's initial impetus into this whole thing was to basically have a way to play games that made it even more fun or even more immersive. And since the acquisition in 2014, so basically for the past 5 years now, that has certainly not been the case. I wouldn't say that gaming is not a big part of Oculus's mission anymore, because it is. If you look at what they're putting out and where they're putting the resources, it is still largely gaming oriented. But the branding, the messaging, and just their overall objective has really changed. But to actually get to your question, I would say that I am as bullish about the future of VR as ever, but I definitely think it's going to take longer than I expected and longer than other people expected. Once the acquisition happened, there was this idea that it supercharged the industry and increased a lot of investments and made it more real. And I think that a lot of that was definitely true. But a lot of the people who made those investments or who jumped into the industry that hadn't been there from the beginning had more of a gold rush mentality. And when they didn't get any gold very quickly, they started to exit the industry. And, I think that anyone who is following VR since 2012, which is the tail end of VR history in general, I think that no one really expected that, because at the very least, the headset that Oculus put out and that the HTC Vive, that HTC put out called the Vive, that, you needed a high-performing PC to run with those headsets, which most people don't have, and only really, not only really, but mostly that's something that a lot of hardcore gamers would have. So there was always that friction point from the start, and I think that Oculus and did a very poor job of catering to that audience. And so I still think it's going to take a while. The future is going to be standalone, like the Oculus Quest that's coming out. But, one thing that I ended up removing from early in the book, because, length was always an issue and it didn't seem critical at the time, but I'm probably going to bring it back for future editions, was an early conversation between Palmer Luckey and his co-founder and partner, Brendan Arib, who would become the CEO of Oculus. And, Brendan is very much responsible for making Palmer's initial vision much larger than it was, and making that Kickstarter campaign back in 2012 really successful. And Brendan basically thought that VR could be successful today. And Palmer, who had been working on his, his headsets for the past 3 years and was much more familiar with the VR market, was a little more skeptical and basically said that he knew this community and that it was going to take a long, long time. And I think that they're probably, both right, or at the least I should say that it was a good yin and yang for them to have, because Brendan definitely was a huge, probably the main driver for Oculus' success. But Palmer did, the part that I'm going to bring back into the book, Palmer did make a reference to the PC industry. And what he meant was basically that, in the late 1970s, personal computers started to become popular, started to become affordable. Apple emerged on the scene, and it was the beginning of the quote-unquote PC revolution. But really, the audience for Apple's original computers and the audience that Steve Wozniak was building for were hardcore enthusiasts and homebrew hackers. And, it wasn't, my family didn't own a PC until 1995. So it took 15 years after that to really hit a mainstream audience. So I don't think it's going to take 15 years for this, particularly because of the augmented reality component of all this, which is a whole other bag of worms. But I think it's going to take about 15 years. I think it's going to take closer to the PC. It's going to be closer to the PC revolution than the smartphone revolution. And I still think gaming is going to be a big part of it, and I don't think that's going to change. So I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, I mean, I've noticed in the last month probably that Facebook's iOS app now has a tab on the left side, just, pretty central above your friends and groups tabs with Oculus. And if you click on it, there comes up with basically an e-commerce link to buy the Oculus, and then it's promoting Netflix and Red Bull TV alongside the game. So it's very much focused on the all-round entertainment, I guess, rather than just games. And I wonder if something like what Google's just revealed with its, what's the name? I forgot. Stadia.
Oh, Stadia. Yeah, Stadia. They announced Stadia at GDC last week.
Yeah, like if there's a potential for that kind of technology, that server-based power to make it a bit more accessible to people who don't have a computer that's able to run Oculus. But I guess we'll only find out as time goes on.
Well, I would also add that in addition to finding out as time goes on, I'm very confident that Facebook is going to mess up the messaging behind it. you know, I think whether or not Google Stadia ends up being successful, they did a really nice job of launching it last week and just sort of explaining their vision for it. And Facebook has historically, and very much so with Oculus, just done a terrible job of that every step of the way. So I'm joking a little bit, but hopefully it's something that Facebook changes in the near future.
Yeah, it's a difficult thing to get right when the market's so diverse and so huge, and I guess they just need to decide who they want to market it to. But marketing is going to be a bit of a ongoing theme here, because that's really, I guess, at the core of what Console Wars was about in some ways, talking about the way that Sega approached Nintendo as the behemoth at the time and tried to build their own Mario killer, which turned out to be Sonic. And you've got probably the most knowledge of that of anyone that wasn't actually there at the time, due to the amount of research and interviews you've done about that period in the 90s. So let's talk first about your history as a gamer, and then we'll go into the video game that you've chosen to talk about today. So probably growing up in like the late 80s, early 90s, I'm guessing that was a very Nintendo focused time.
Yeah, you know, so I like what you said, that I'm probably one of the foremost experts amongst people who weren't there. The way I often felt about my role of interviewing hundreds of people from that era was I kind of felt like a Ghostbuster, and I'd, you know, throw out the little capture device and get Tom Kalinske, the CEO of Sega America, or Diane Fornasier, or Al Nelson, or Peter Main, and collect all their stories. But yeah, so 25 years before that, I was a kid. I grew up in, I was born in 1982, so you were totally right. You know, Nintendo was an enormous part of my early childhood. I got my first experience with video games was with a Nintendo Entertainment System, an 8-bit NES, which I got for a Christmas in the late 80s. I don't remember which year. It was a gift from my grandfather, from my grandparents to my brother and I, to my younger brother. He's 2 years younger than me. And as you'll probably hear me say, unintentionally, I'll often say we when talking about my favorite Sega Nintendo memories. And that's because so much of them are oriented around me and my younger brother, which was nice for a lot of reasons. One being that I was kind of a jerk older brother, and playing video games together was like one of the only things that we're able to do in a mostly civil manner. But so we got an NES for Christmas, and I remember opening it up and being super excited because I had heard about it and I knew it was this really cool thing. But I also remember having like no idea what it actually was, or kind of like what a video game was. You know, I guess it didn't really make sense to me. I remember my uncle kind of trying to describe it as like you control a cartoon. Because I love cartoons. So, you know, like you basically, it's like, you know, watching TV, watching cartoons, except you get to control the characters. And I didn't really understand what that meant until, you know, we brought the NES home and booted up the original cartridge it came with, which was half, you know, the Super Mario Brothers and then Duck Hunt. And we were off and running. The next several years of my life, Nintendo was a huge part of it. Back in the day, it was, you know, kids don't have very much disposable income. Games were very expensive, so they were really only things that we, my brother and I, got as like gifts. I mean, we got, I think, a 75-cent allowance for bringing down the garbage twice a week. So it would have taken like a year and a half or so to save up for a game. So maybe we got one that way.
That sounds like slave labor. 75 cents. <Gee. laughs>
Well, you got to remember about inflation. No, I don't know. Hey, it was some money. It was better than nothing.
I guess that's $2 now.
Yeah. But, you know, it taught us hard work and discipline. And it finally, you know, I'm sure that it taught my brother and I to learn to ask for a raise at some point. but, you know, like I think back, and my first, the first thing that comes to mind when you ask about Nintendo era is like dozens of games, most of them great. But then I kind of shrink that all back and remember what my actual library was. And it was very small. You know, it was hard to get games. So I think that we had that Mario Duck Hunt game. that came with the system. I think our first, you know, game that we asked for and got was either Mega Man 2 or Zelda, and those were pretty much the two that we played along with, along with Contra and along with Super Mario Bros. 2. And then I think over the course of time, we ended up getting probably two or three other games. I actually remember one of them, my very wealthy aunt was coming to visit, and we always liked when she visited because she often brought gifts. And so my brother and I decided that the game that we were going to ask for was Q-Bert, because Q-Bert looked so cool. And we got it, and that was awesome. And then we put it into the NES and hated it, and like had no idea how to play it. And I think that we never played it again. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean to speak ill of Q-Bert, but it's more so just the fact that our entire decision making was based probably on something we saw on Nintendo Power or heard about from a friend or just saw in a circular, and we really had no idea what to expect from the game, and it wasn't what we wanted. But that's just how things went back then. And anyway, despite the Q-Bert fiasco or the guilt that we felt for getting this game that cost $50 and we never played, we had wonderful memories from the 8-bit era. And then naturally, my brother and I very much wanted to get the Super Nintendo. And so it must have been like late 1991, probably heading into the Christmas or actually Hanukkah season for us. And I remember we put together sort of the childhood equivalent of a PowerPoint presentation to explain to my dad why him and my mom should totally buy us a Super Nintendo and how we would, sacrifice our next several birthdays or, Valentine's Days or whatever we could use. Maybe we'll make sure to get the garbage up and down even faster or something, whatever we said. And then my father, who is pretty much my favorite person in the world and my role model, so he was always a very good, loving parent. He still is, but he said no, and that kind of shocked us. And when we asked why, he said because Nintendo would just come out with a Super Duper Nintendo and a Super Super Duper Nintendo. And of course, my dad was right in the long, long view of things. But really, what his response was about was just a lot of parents being angry that the SNES was not backwardly compatible with the 8-bit games that they had purchased already. Yeah. Right. And so, later on, that would actually be a trigger point for what got me into writing Console Wars, because it just sort of made me realize that my childhood was shaped by what happened next, by my parents then getting us a Super Nintendo. The opposite of that, actually. Shaped by my parents getting us a Sega Genesis and not a Super Nintendo. And that basically all just happened because, people in the boardroom decided that the SNES was not going to be backwardly compatible, that it wasn't worth the cost. And then lo and behold, because of that business decision, I became a Sega kid, and that totally defined a lot of my identity during 1992 and, 1996. And it led me to many of my all-time favorite games like NHL 94, Toe Jam and Earl, and Joe Montana Football, and then, of course, Sonic the Hedgehog and Sonic the Hedgehog 2.
Sure, and which game have we decided to talk about today? And maybe you can tell us why it stands out for you to talk about on a podcast called One Perfect Game.
Because Sonic is just perfect, man. There's a lot of reasons. I think, like you mentioned earlier, the marketing was a big part of Sega's success, and I'm... a tribute to that. The marketing totally worked on me. I think I had mentioned to you the previous time that we spoke that at my core, I am a Mario guy. Like, I am someone who enjoys slower platformers. I like the exploratory nature of Mario games. I love nowadays how they've sort of created a scavenger hunt aspect to find the golden coins in each level. Like, that's totally me. that's what I like. And yet, for a long period of time in my life, and even to today, like, the marketing made me want to be a Sega person and made me feel like I needed to find myself in a Mario killer like Sonic the Hedgehog. I think that it was just a perfect match of timing and, a more mature-seeming game than Mario. And Sonic is just lovable. Sonic is, he did have that that Bart Simpson, naughty, early 90s, zeitgeisty aspect to him, with the toe tap and with how fast he went. And he had attitude, but he also was like a kind of cute-looking, friendly, nice-seeming character. And this is all marketing and character stuff we're talking about, but the game itself I think is awesome. I loved Sonic the Hedgehog 1. That was the first game we had for a while, and my brother and I played that through a million times, and so heading into Sonic 2, we didn't know what to expect. The previous favorite games that we had had that had had sequels, like Mario or Zelda, their second games had been fun, but not as fun, and noticeably like wonky or very different. So we didn't know if Sonic 2 was going to be different than Sonic 1, and it was very much the same, but with the addition of the Tails character. And so then that was a big part of 2, why that's my one perfect game, because it was, again, Wii. It goes back to Wii. It was something that my brother and I could play at the same time. You know, playing Tails in that game is certainly not the best, but at least you could do it together. And experience, you know, taking down Dr. Robotnik or the quest to do so.
Yeah, I guess, yeah, so we're talking about Sonic 2, and for me, like, I have similar memories playing with my older brother. We had a Mega Drive, which is what the Genesis was called in Australia, and, yep. like, playing Sonic a lot was the very formative part of my addiction to video games, because it was, as you mentioned, you only have a couple of games, and that was the one that we had when we bought the console, so we played that a ton. And that when we discovered that there was a Sonic 2, you know, that was, I wonder what it could be, what's the difference? Then, you know, you assume that it's always going to be better when it's the second. And the addition of multiplayer for a family of two boys is a huge thing, because it's not that old passing the controller back and forth, but actually right. both getting to control a player on the screen, which was pretty cool thing at the time. And it really just takes what you have in the first Sonic game, and at the time we're looking at it as taking it to the next level, and I'm guessing right. that it was similar for you guys as you played through that game together,
for sure. And something that hadn't really occurred to me right now is just that you know, if you look at the early Mario game, the first Super Mario Brothers, which is obviously it was a groundbreaking game, and that game was really hard. At least to those of us who lived through it, like, you know, it was very hard to find the extra life, one up mushrooms. You know, there weren't that many power ups. There were no save points in the middle of the, you know, levels. I guess you can go to the warp pipes to go back to it. But, you know, if you look at that Mario game, compared to the third Mario, or compared to the Mario that I played 25 or, you know, 30 minutes ago on my Nintendo Switch that I was playing before we started talking, like, I now have 75 lives in that Mario game. And the point that I'm trying to make is that while those Mario games are really fun, they also intentionally got a lot easier and sort of like lower stakes, which is probably a good thing. But, you know, compared to Sonic, that was different. Sonic was much closer to the difficulty level of Mario 1 than the as long as you keep playing, you're going to win aspect of like Super Mario World or Mario Bros. 3. And also just the nature of Sonic with the rings. You know, Mario collects the coins, and, you know, if you get 100, you get an extra life. But Sonic's entire power is based on the rings, and if you get hit, you lose all of them. You know, it's sort of like an all-or-nothing proposition with Sonic. And I think that made the game harder. It also made it very different. But I think that's part of the reason that it lives on strongly, is that it was a very fun game. You know, I dare anyone who played it back then to try to play it today and not smile within the first, you know, 20 seconds, or even when it just boots up and says Sega, and you see Sonic and Tails bouncing around. But, you know, like, it was hard, and it went very fast, so that made it especially hard. And there's some of those iconic levels in the game, like the Vegas level, which really had that pachinko slot machine mechanic that Sonic was sort of based on, and that brought that to the forefront. So I think the game holds up pretty well.
Yeah, there's definitely not another feeling like getting hit and losing all those coins and then trying yeah. to scramble to like collect yeah. as many of them as possible as they bounce away. It's like, no.
Yeah, exactly.
So, and that's an interesting point, just talking about what makes Sonic unique. What do you think, because you've mentioned Mario games, you've mentioned Mega Man, which are iconic platformers and some of the best of all time. What makes Sonic 2 stand out to you as someone that did experience those games in the context of when they came out?
Yeah, so in terms of like the larger story, the business story, the one I wrote about, the release of Sonic 2 was this global launch event called Sonic Tuesday that was a big deal. And I had no idea about that as a kid, so I guess their marketing didn't fully work or whatever, but you know, what worked for me was really that taking it to the next level aspect. And I know that you and I have talked in passing just about games, and we're talking about sequels, and you made a good point that sort of what made Mega Man 2 a great sequel was that it introduced the slide move. And so it wasn't like a totally, a brand new from scratch game. It was the same game, but with, you know, different characters, different levels, and kind of, you know, just a few new game mechanics. And that's what Sonic did so well with the Sonic Dash move, and then also the introduction of Tails. I think the game was really light, it's a very fun game. Like, it's very upbeat, even though it's a platformer. Like, you know, Mega Man, I think, is a little bit darker. It's a little bit colder. It's a little bit less amiable, and I think that the first and second Marios were kind of like that, but Sonic was really fun, really friendly. The Green Hill Zone levels are like kind of like, if I die and I have to go to some place, that would probably be on my short list of places I'd want to live for eternity. What else made it really good? I didn't know this at the time, but I would later learn that the game Sega was and still is a Japanese-based company. The parent company is based in Japan. And so the first Sonic was engineered by Yuji Naka and a small team of programmers, and that was done in Japan. But the second game was actually programmed in America. And since so much of my book did focus on this battle and for power between Sega of America and Sega of Japan, I do sort of think of Sega 2 as this perfect balance between America and Japan, a balance that wouldn't last. But I think there's a more American sensibility to Sonic 2. I guess it's probably unfair for me to say that because I don't know exactly what makes it that way. But I do often think that that's sort of what makes games great. Not an American sensibility, but just sort of aspects that you can't even put into words, which is also maybe a little bit embarrassing for a writer. Like, I should be able to do that. But it kind of goes more to what I was saying earlier about, how you just almost automatically smile when you play the game. Like, it just... like when a great game works, it just feels right. Like, you kind of feel like you're the character. Everything, all the movements and the spinning and the loop-de-loops, it just all feels right, and it just worked perfectly with Sonic 2. And that to me is like the pinnacle of the franchise, and certainly one of the games I would bring with me if I was trapped on a desert island, but somehow it had electricity and a console.
Yeah, a coconut-generated console. That'd be great.
Exactly.
I have to do a small correction. I think it was Mega Man 3 that introduced the slide on the NES.
Ah, okay.
But that's fine. You know, it's been a long time.
So my brother and I were deprived of that with our 10-game Nintendo library. But your point was a good one. Or NHL 94 is one of my favorite games. And I remember on the box, and when I wrote this piece about it, the big thing was it introduced the one-timer. So, they weren't rebuilding Rome in a day. They already had a successful thing, but they just added little tweaks. And I think that is a good way to do a sequel.
Sure. And it's interesting you mentioned like that mashup between the American and Japanese teams, because I guess the original idea for Sonic that is detailed in your book as far as his appearance was one that's very different to what we know today from Sonic, with a leather jacket and electric guitar, fangs, and this kind of really out there idea of what kids would think is cool. So I guess America was able to bring that back into a more realistic perspective, and the Japanese are absolutely able to do some stuff that we wouldn't be able to come up with on our own. When I say our, I'm talking about the Western world, I suppose, because I'm not American.
Yeah.
But like, getting into more of kind of what's happened to Sonic since Sonic 2, do you feel like that straying into the 3D worlds and the way that his character has taken on a personality that's, I don't know, like very different with the storylines and crazy stuff that I've seen happening in the more recent games, that is kind of lost its way from what Sonic was to kids back then?
Yeah, I definitely do. I would be surprised to find someone who thinks that everything is on track with Sonic, or that, to say, oh, Sonic 1 and 2 were okay, but really Sonic Adventure 1 and 2 is where it's at. So I think the fact that no one's really making that case is pretty indicative of it being very unlikely to be the case.
Mm.
But it's interesting what you were saying. Yeah, for me, I didn't realize how much Sonic could have been a different character. The original version of him, or the original incarnations of him, in one version, he had a busty, human girlfriend named Madonna. At some point, he had fangs. He was very very lanky. He wasn't very smooth. He wasn't very cute looking. And sort of the best contrast for that in how it might have worked if the Japanese version had gotten past the licensing issues of like Madonna and the band and all that is that game Sonic Generations, which probably was my favorite Sonic game of the past 5 or 10 years. Sonic Mania was also very fun, but Sonic Generations, you know, actually introduces like iconic classic Sonic and modern Sonic, and you'll notice the modern Sonic is a lot more like that original Japanese vision for Sonic. And I guess I hadn't really realized that, you know, year after year just playing Sonic games, but to sort of actually take a step back and say, oh, wow, this guy does look and does move very different than the one from 15, 20 years ago. I think that, you know, but Sonic Mania was, in my opinion, a very good step forward, or maybe even step sideways for the franchise, because as you had, you know, you pointed out, that the games soon after became 3D and Sonic didn't maybe seem to translate that well. But Sonic Mania does capture a lot of the feel and the simplicity of those earlier Sonic games. And maybe that, you know, they're going to continue to make a lot of, you know, 3D crazy graphics, different Sonic, you know, a Sonic that seems different to me games, but I'd like for them to also kind of make more games like Sonic Mania. At least I'll be here to buy those. But yeah, I think that some degree too is probably nostalgia. Like I don't know what it would take for them to ever create a Sonic game that I would ever admit was as good as Sonic 1 or 2. So I have to, you know, concede my own bias there. And then I also just want to say, like, the fact that we're even still talking about Sonic games, that they're still being made, you know, is an achievement in its own right. You know, other, you know, I guess like, you know, mascot characters have come and gone, and, you know, there's not too many Crash Bandicoot games being made. There's not too many Spyro games being made. There's some, you know, there's not too many Pac-Man games or Frogger games being made. So the fact that Sonic has withstood the test of time, I think, is very much a tribute to the marketing. And obviously, if not for the game itself, like, you know, I don't want to say, oh, this is all just, you know, the American marketing. Clearly, the game itself had to be awesome to really capture that lightning in a bottle. But it is oftentimes amazing to me that people still talk about Sonic, that my younger cousin still knows who Sonic is after 20 years of not awesome games.
Yeah, I guess that says something about the appeal of the character fundamentally, that kids still seem to find him cool. And I guess the inclusion in games like Super Smash Bros. And other kind of Mario crossovers have kept him in the public eye. And, you know, now we have a movie coming out with some horrifying promotional art so far, but, you know, hopefully that they can balance the tone of that and make it into something that's not a complete meme, but we'll see.
Yeah, and part of what is, I think, hurt the Sonic franchise too, it's kind of an obvious thing, is that Sega got out of the hardware business after Dreamcast. They didn't really have a Sonic game for some of those later consoles, which was almost just unacceptable. Like, that's kind of crazy. But you know, basically, I'm a proud owner of the Nintendo Switch. I've bought the Wii U, the Wii. I love Nintendo stuff. So the point that I'm trying to make is that, you know, Nintendo always has virtual consoles, or now they have their subscription service, which I subscribe to. And I've purchased Mario Brothers 3, one of my favorite games, like what feels like a million times. And so I'm often playing it every few years just because I'm playing it with the new hardware. But the same is not true with Sonic the Hedgehog franchise. You know, I bought the Sonic Collection for the Nintendo 3DS. So that was the last time I played it, like 3 or 4 years ago. But I think that's probably also hurt the appeal of the Sonic games, is that they're not, you know, he's not a flagship character for a console that's, you know, constantly being demoed for you, or having commercials for you, or, you know, getting you to try to play. And so I think a lot of people also just haven't even played a lot of these Sonic games because they hear that they're not good, and it's not, you know, they don't have to, he's not the mascot of any piece of hardware. So I think that's also just hurt Sonic on the game side. But to your point, you know, as a character, he does seem to have some je ne sais quoi appeal, and you know, this many years later, he's still appealing to new audiences and very much to the older audiences.
Do you have a Like, have you seen a copy of the Sonic with the leather jacket and electric guitar in your travels?
Unfortunately, there's not that much that was saved from the early era. And we're talking about 1990 here at this point. But we are doing a documentary of the Sega Nintendo battle. This Wii is not me and my brother. This Wii is me and my screenwriting partner, Jonah Tulis. And, you know, we have been able to acquire some of the early iterations of Sonic. You know, none of these are never before seen. They're all stuff that, you know, if you could probably find online, along with the other characters that were not selected in the mascot contest that did the old Sonic. But there's a few things out there of him with the Rock Band. There's a few images of him with Madonna. Like, I can send you some stuff after the show, or listeners can just, Google early Sonic sketches. But, like, you know, there's never one where he's totally extreme. Like, it was always just, like I said earlier, like different iterations. Like, one he had fangs, another one he had a leather jacket. So, like, there's no, like, total crazy Sonic, but it's certainly different. Yeah, it's different than the one that we know and love. And it also just shows, like, how subtleties can make these things seem so different, because they're not that different, but they definitely have a very different feel.
Yeah, I have tried to Google that and had no luck. So if you can send me stuff, I'd enjoy having a good chuckle at that. So, Blake, thanks for coming on the show. It's been really interesting to hear, I guess, your perspective. It's not only someone that grew up with those games, but has a very deep understanding of the culture of Sega and marketing and the stuff we talked about with VR too. So yeah, it's been really great.
Awesome. Thanks so much for having me on. And I look forward to returning to this podcast or to your podcast at a later date.
That'd be great. So where can people find you if they wish?
People can find me on Twitter at Blake J. Harris NYC. I'm not very good at many things, but I'm very good at responding to questions eventually. I have a compulsive need to not leave things unaddressed there. And then on my website, blakejharris.com. All one word. There's details about both my books. There's photos and images of the characters and links to the media and press stuff. So, you know, on Twitter at Blake J. Harris NYC or just blakejharris.com.
Very good. And of course, Console Wars and the History of the Future, available at all good book retailers, I'm sure.
Yeah, should be available anywhere. Let me know if it's not, so I can get on them.
Is there an audiobook for...
And there's audiobooks for both of them, yeah.
Fantastic, Great. And I guess thanks to Matt Tilby for letting me host his podcast. It's fun to mix it up and do something a bit different, get a chance to talk with Blake yet again. And you can follow Matt on Twitter at itstilby. This podcast is OPG Pod. And, of course, my podcast, Putting In Work, goes up every Thursday as part of the 8-Bit Collective. So thank you very much, dear listeners, and have a fantastic day.